the streetlights come on. It's getting dark. She's supposed to be home before the streetlights come on. She wasn't home yet, so I'm thinking she's just out there playing with a friend. She never came home.
She should be playing with a friend. She should be going to school and enjoying herself. Not strangled, murdered, and treated like a piece of garbage.
Seeing her laying there smoldering is tore you up. It's one of those cases that never leave you. And Stanley's making sure of that.
There's no doubt whatsoever in my mind or heart that they have the right man.
He looked at and or processed 10,000 items of evidence and never found anything that connected Jennifer and Stanley.
I mean, I like cheese, but I'm not a rat. I like kids, but not like that.
You're listening to Suspect Convictions, a podcast from WVIK and Scott Reeder, re-examining the murder of Jennifer Lewis. Jennifer's body was found on September 17, 1990, behind Jefferson Elementary School in Davenport, Iowa. The autopsy shows she had been sexually assaulted, strangled, and set on fire. She was 9 years old. Police arrested a man named Stanley Liggins for the crime. He was convicted twice, but both convictions were overturned. He'll go to trial for a third time this May. In the first two episodes of this podcast, we talked about the details of the crime scene and about Jennifer's short life. You can listen to them at suspectconvictions.com. But now we're going to explore the factors that led to Stanley's arrest and the evidence used to convict him. In the years since Stanley's convictions, many doubts have been raised about the prosecution's timeline of the night Jennifer was killed. In November, we presented Stanley's case to the Illinois Innocence Project in Springfield. It's a nonprofit organization of lawyers and students that provides legal research services. They help bring justice to people who have been wrongfully convicted. The Illinois Innocence Project has a number of guidelines for the cases they take. Stanley Liggins doesn't qualify. First of all, he was convicted in Iowa, and he also already had his conviction overturned and is awaiting his new trial. And we're not suggesting Stanley was wrongfully convicted. But we talked with some of the lawyers and students in Springfield about the case to see if it followed any patterns for the types of cases they investigate. You'll hear from some of the lawyers and students throughout this episode. But back to 1990. On September 24th, about a week after Jennifer was murdered, Scott County Prosecutor Bill Davis decided to charge Stanley Liggins with Jennifer's murder.
I was one of the few people in my office that agreed that we had sufficient evidence to proceed and get a conviction. Since I was the one who ran for office and the only one in the office who could lose his job and one who was going to try the case, that was my opinion was the only one that was truly important.
He said it wasn't common to make an arrest that quickly.
Well, the fact that he was the one who had been last seen with her early on. And we had a witness who identified the car as being in the area where Jennifer was found. And we don't usually make a quick arrest that quickly because the time runs against the state as soon as the arrest starts. But we made an exception, of course, because of the type of crime that it was and the person who had committed it, we've concluded, was a danger to society, and we had an obligation to the public to make an early arrest if possible. And we did, and we went from there.
Here's the timeline recounting the last hours of Jennifer Lewis's life, according to closing arguments by Assistant Scott County Prosecutor Joseph Grubesich. At 5:30 p.m., the night of the murder, Stanley Liggins came to Jennifer's Rock Island home to visit her mother and stepfather, Sherry and Joseph Glenn. After Jennifer left to ride her bike, Stanley followed her and was seen by a neighbor talking to Jennifer in the next block. 1 hour later, at 6:30 p.m., Jennifer and Stanley returned to the house. Stanley gave Jennifer a dollar bill and asked her to walk to a nearby liquor store to buy him a package of gum. Stanley slipped away from the home and is next seen standing outside Max Discount Liquors in Rock Island while Jennifer is inside buying the gum. It's the last time Jennifer is seen alive. At 7:38 p.m., there was a call from Stanley to the Glen residence. The prosecution says Stanley asked if Jennifer had returned with the gum. He told Joseph Glenn he was in a bar, but Joseph said he heard no noises in the background. By this time, Joseph and Sherry became worried because Jennifer did not return home. At 7:50, Stanley is seen standing outside his second floor room at the Hillside Inn Motel in Rock Island, looking out over the parking lot. The prosecution believes he is planning to move Jennifer's body from the motel room. At 8:16, a passerby driving behind Jefferson School in Davenport notices a fire in a field. 10 minutes later, another passerby sees a red foreign car parked behind the school. Its trunk and door are open and a man is standing next to it. A neighbor also sees the car, and she later tells police that its left taillight is brighter than the right one. Stanley drove a red Peugeot, on which the right taillight was partially burned out. At 8:30, Stanley is seen driving the Peugeot quickly in reverse in the Hillside Inn parking lot. 15 minutes later, Stanley shows up at the Glenn residence. After Sherry and Joseph inform him that Jennifer failed to return, Stanley laughs, tells them to call 911, then leaves. 15 minutes later, at 9 p.m., Jennifer's body was found burning behind Jefferson Elementary School by the school's janitor. The body had been stuffed into a garbage bag, doused with gasoline, and set on fire. On the morning after the murder, a woman told police she noticed a gas can in the backseat of Stanley's car after walking next to it and smelling gas fumes. That's the timeline presented by the prosecution. Scott, what stands out to you?
One thing I find really weird in here is how Stanley Liggins gave a dollar to this little girl to go and get a pack of gum. But he left before she could return with the gum. Then he feels the need to call from a bar and ask, did she ever come back with that gum? And it's like, who does that? That doesn't make any sense.
So according to this timeline, that phone call happened 1 hour and 8 minutes after Jennifer is last seen at the liquor store. Now for context, the Glenn's house was about a 3-minute walk from the store.
Yeah, they weren't very far apart at all. So if she was walking over there to get the gum and coming back, you know, what would it have taken, 10 minutes?
Also, Stanley and Jennifer both lived and were last seen in Rock Island, Illinois, but her body was found in Davenport, Iowa. It was a 15-minute drive from the Hillside Inn Motel to Jefferson Elementary School.
Yeah. These are communities that hug the Mississippi River. They're in different states, but they essentially function as one community called the Quad City Metropolitan Area.
So fast forward, police collected forensic evidence from the hotel room and Stanley Liggins' car. Stanley's lawyer in the second trial, Mike Toby, explains what they found.
The Des Moines criminal lab guy admitted on the witness stand that he estimated that he looked at and or processed 10,000 items of forensic type evidence. And never found anything that connected Jennifer and Stanley.
However, Scott, they did find that the trash bag Jennifer's body was wrapped in was the same brand as the trash bags used at the Hillside Inn where Stanley Liggins lived.
That's interesting because that's something he would absolutely have had access to if he was inclined to do something like this. But it was a very common brand. I think it was Hefty. And there was testimony that the Quad City market was the fourth largest market in the nation for that particular brand of trash bags.
Yeah, in fact, the trash bag they examined was a 30-gallon black Hefty trash bag. At that time in 1990, 85% of the Quad City's trash bag market was made up of Hefty bags. There was a manufacturer about 150 miles south in Jacksonville, Illinois. The prosecution's timeline also mentioned several witnesses. Prosecutor Bill Davis says the first one put Stanley near the liquor store.
We had a guy who, and again, witnesses are who you find, not who you would select. And I can't think of his name. I can sure picture him, who was over there and saw Jennifer there and saw Stanley someplace in the area, too.
That witness was Antonio Holmes. An Iowa appellate court ruling states Antonio identified Stanley Liggins in a photo lineup 3 days after the murder. The next day, Holmes went back to the police to say he was inebriated at the time of the identification and couldn't be sure Stanley was the man he saw outside the store. He later claimed he never took back the identification, but a Rock Island detective testified that's what happened. Another witness saw a red foreign car with the trunk and driver's door open, and the next one testified she was in the neighborhood the night of the murder. She looked out the window of her boyfriend's house and saw a small fire and a car with distinctive taillights. One light was much brighter than the other. That description matched Stanley Liggins' car, a red Peugeot. Detective Kevin Murphy says the gas can they found in the back seat of Stanley's car and the two witnesses who described the red Peugeot near the fire led police to focus on the vehicle.
And that's why we put the car in the courtroom, because it's a valuable, valuable piece of evidence.
During the trial, the prosecution wheeled the back end of Stanley's Peugeot into the courtroom, turned on the lights, and the witness testified she would recognize those taillights anywhere. Denny Kern was the head of the identification section of the Davenport Police Department. He was impressed by her testimony.
You know, it was one of those people that when she's speaking and telling you what she saw, this is somebody who's telling you what she saw. But she was specific about it, and that was kind of neat to see. You know, somebody who actually, what she had to say, she was sure of.
But later, after Stanley had been convicted of the murder for the second time, more information came out. According to an Iowa appellate court ruling, this witness had a history as a paid police informant for one of the senior officers in the detective bureau. We have chosen not to identify her because she has not yet been identified by name as a police informant in public court documents. But Scott went to talk to her a few months ago. She denied ever having a connection to the police and says she didn't know anybody at the department. She still insisted she saw the taillights that night. Records released since the two convictions do confirm that she was paid by the police about 80 times over the span of several years. She started working as a paid informant the year before Stanley's first trial. Mike Toby isn't surprised she's denying her connection to the Davenport police.
I would just have to surmise that she will deny that until she feels like she is surrounded by her protectors, the police. So if in this upcoming trial, when that is made part of the cross-examination, she will admit to being an informant.
But Bill Davis thinks there's a different reason she wouldn't admit her history as an informant to Scott.
He's a large man, he's a white man, and he's got a middle-class bearing and accent, and no, he is not the kind of guy that she's going to react to. She wanted to keep that a secret, if even the accusation of being an informant, because in the neighborhood she lives in, and with the community that she lives in, that is truly an outcast, and she would be treated as such, and she would have to be frightened, not just treated discourteously, but maybe with some violence.
Jennifer's body had been doused with gasoline and set on fire. Police found a gas can in the back seat of Stanley's Peugeot with his fingerprint on the handle. The display of the car in the courtroom included that gas can in the back seat. Chris Weiner is a reporter with WQAD Channel 8. She was there covering Stanley's first trial.
When you saw the gas can in that back seat, it was overwhelming. You could almost, you know, if you were a juror, I know what I felt, you know, you could almost smell the gasoline. You couldn't, but you could almost smell the gasoline in your head.
Mike DeMone is a staff member with the Illinois Innocence Project. Of course, he wasn't there in the courtroom, but as a lawyer, he sees that piece of evidence differently.
I don't think the gas can itself actually means anything, because like in the 90s, people had gas cans all the time in their car, because if you didn't have a cell phone and you ran out of gas and you were in a bad spot, like that was something that my parents always had in their cars, and my parents were to rural ingenuity what rocks are to swimming.
But Chris says it wasn't that common.
The only reason, in my mind, you would have a gas can is if you ran out of gas or you were going to power a lawnmower, you know, but it wasn't common.
After Jennifer's murder, the police first began to focus on Jennifer's mother, Sherry, and stepfather, Joseph Glenn, who went by the name Ace. They were brought in for questioning and given a polygraph test. Scott interviewed Jim Hammes, who was the polygraph operator at the time.
I polygraphed Ace, and I said, came out and I said, he didn't do it. They were all pissed. I mean, they thought, who in the hell is this young polygraph examiner, blah, 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 and I was. I graduated from polygraph school in November of 89. Now you said September, not even a year, and I don't know how much I had done, but I said, he didn't do it. He showed no reaction whatsoever. And the FBI agent even said, I knew I should have brought one of my men in to test him. And I said, well, the next time, bring your own fucking man in. And, you know, that's just what I said to him. So I was pissed. And now they're challenging my integrity. You know?
What was the mother like?
I know she passed. I remember her vaguely.
Then, based on several witnesses pointing toward Stanley, police wanted to talk to him. They went to the Hillside Inn and took Stanley to the Davenport Police Department for questioning. Stanley took a polygraph as well.
And I ran a test on him. Did you, da ba ba, you know, he said, oh, you flunked. So I ran a second test on it, different type of test. It's called a peak of tension test.
Okay.
And in that test, I have a little synopsis on such a date. Jennifer Lewis was found up by Jefferson High School. She was on fire. And anyway, did she die from, and I said, a gunshot wound. Did she die from being knifed to death? I listed seven different causes of death and even fire. Did she die from being set on fire? And I had strangulation in there. Well, he nailed strangulation. I mean, he reacted that big time. If a guy was not knowing how someone died, but they knew in the paper a guy was on fire.
So did he answer, or just how he responded?
No, he said no. He said no to all of them.
Okay.
But because of his reaction, he reacted to the strangulation because he knew that's how she died. So then I went over and told him, that's the guy. Well, then I was a hero.
A polygraph measures a suspect's breathing, perspiration, heart rate, and blood pressure. George Mashke is the co-founder of the website antipolygraph.org. He's a former Army Reserve intelligence officer and active duty Army interrogator. He says these factors that a polygraph measures aren't necessarily correlated with deception.
Any number of stimuli can produce these responses, like heavier breathing or more sweating or higher pulse rate, higher blood pressure. For example, just being asked an accusatory question about something you didn't do or wouldn't even conceive of doing could cause a reaction that polygraphers assume is indicative of deception.
So he says the results of a polygraph should not direct the focus of an investigation. John Hanlon, the executive director of the Illinois Innocence Project, agrees.
Polygraphs are the ultimate example of junk science. They are something that law enforcement tends to rely upon when it's convenient for them, but even more than that, tends to use to try to tunnel vision toward a particular suspect. I mean, we admit in our courtrooms bite mark evidence. We admit all kinds of evidence that the National Academy of Sciences has said is not reliable as science. But even our courts don't admit polygraphs as evidence. And that, to me, is the ultimate statement of the garbage, frankly, that it is.
Bill Davis says in his 30 years of prosecuting, he doesn't believe he has ever prosecuted an innocent person.
I want all of the assurances that I can get. So early on in the investigation, as I want to know that we're going down the right path, putting this case together for one thing, and I need to be assured that I'm trying a guilty person. There's a reason they're not admissible. It's because they're not foolproof, and it's one, it invades the province of a jury. It's a tool, an investigative tool, and I treat it just as that.
But then there was that peak of tension test that polygrapher Jim Hammes says suggested Stanley knew how Jennifer died. George Mashke says that test could have some credibility.
There's not a lot of science to support such a conclusion, but it has some plausible basis, and it's different from a lie test. It's not really a test for whether someone is telling the truth or not. It's a test whether one option seems salient to the person who's being tested.
Stanley Liggins was questioned on September 19th, 2 days after Jennifer's murder. That night, he signed a consent form that gave police permission to search his motel room. Later, Stanley told the press that he signed the document on the condition that police could only seize evidence related to the murder. He had drug paraphernalia in the room, and he didn't want that used against him in court. Bill Davis says it's possible police made this false promise in order to get Stanley to sign the consent form.
They're allowed to do it, and it is plausible as to whether or not that's actually what happened. I can't speak to it.
During the search, police found a coffee grinder with about half a gram of cocaine residue inside. They also found small paper squares and pieces of aluminum foil, which are often used to package drugs. Police also seized a stun gun. Early the next morning, Stanley was arrested for cocaine possession. He was held on a nearly $500,000 bond, which he wasn't able to pay. And days later, he was arrested for sexual abuse, arson, and the murder of Jennifer Lewis. Defense attorney Mike Toby says he was charged in Iowa, even though police couldn't prove where exactly the crimes happened.
The only thing connecting Iowa with the offense is the fact that the dead body is found there, and there's a presumption that's allowable that where a body was found is where a homicide, or the death anyway, occurred.
Stanley awaited trial in the Scott County Jail. His cellmate at the time, Frank Rising, later testified against Stanley in court.
I didn't know what he did until I got my TV in that night. And I told him, I said, "That's you, you motherfucker." And he says, "Yeah, it's me, but they'll never get me for it." And, well, they were listening on the speakers. And I was brought out of my cell and told I needed to testify or else I'd be charged with accessory after the fact.
Mike Toby says police use a number of techniques to get information from both suspects and witnesses.
The only way they could charge him with being an accessory to a murder would be if they could prove he took some activity other than refusing to discuss what he did or did not know. That is not making you an accessory to any criminal offense. Now, remember, police officers are allowed to lie during interrogation. There are some areas, however, that are supposed to be off limits, one of which is custodial leniency.
In exchange for his testimony, Frank Rising was also told that he could serve his sentence at a nicer prison than a place like Fort Madison in Iowa. Mike Toby says that could be an appealing offer.
Fort Madison is like the Shawshank Redemption times five. The facility itself is a shambles, it's filthy, and it's extraordinarily dangerous. I think the Iowa Supreme Court would find that that is such a nebulous and in the future type promise that it wouldn't be viewed as an improper inducement.
The prosecution built their case largely around circumstantial evidence, like eyewitnesses. Bill Davis says that isn't a bad thing.
Don't be misled by dramatizations about circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial evidence is evidence. Look at the rules of evidence, and the rules of evidence don't say, hey, this is circumstantial evidence, so you weigh it in a different way. Evidence is evidence, and the jury is permitted and directed to give the weight that the evidence deserves.
But he says this case stands out as being sad and difficult. The case was also tough for Stanley's first defense attorney, Gary McHenrick.
The interstate jurisdictional issues, the suppression issues, I mean, there were a lot of evidentiary issues as we went along. Bill, who I consider a friend and I have a lot of respect for, Bill Davis, you know, he initially was reluctant to turn over the police reports to me. We went quite a while before we were able to get the copies of the police reports from the county attorney's office.
The jury at the first trial in Scott County convicted Stanley. He appealed the conviction, and it was overturned on the grounds that Stanley's history as a drug dealer should not be revealed to the jury. A second trial was granted and was moved to Dubuque, Iowa, about 70 miles north. That jury also found him guilty. We'll hear more details from the trials and the jurors themselves in another episode, but Gary McHenrick explains why the second conviction was also overturned.
In one of the later post-conviction relief cases, it was determined that there were about
78 police reports
that weren't turned over from the police department to the county attorney's office that had some exculpatory evidence.
Bill Davis insists he turned over all evidence.
My position is, and I take it to my grave, those reports were given to the first set of lawyers because somehow they got lost and didn't get to the second lawyer. Not my fault, but I got blamed for it. I never hit a report in my life. And they were innocuous, but now they photocopy and make them sign for everything so that we can document they got it. But we didn't have that system. That was my fault. Didn't have the system at that time. So the court concluded that we had hid those files from them and done it with purpose, and that if the defense had had that, they might have mounted a better defense and it might have changed the jury's mind.
Gary McHenrick says he trusts Bill Davis, and Mike Toby, the second trial defense attorney, agrees that Bill probably didn't withhold the reports.
I never had misgivings about working with Bill Davis. He never broke his word to me that I know of, and I was engaged with him for decades. It is still possible that police officers would do things to assure success for Bill, and not necessarily because he asked them to. There are a few people in that cadre who think of themselves as avenging angels, and that their fight against crime is so crucial that the ends justify the means. And of course, Bill Davis, as the Scott County attorney, and as one who tried cases, primarily the high-profile cases, you know, he was their Zeus, and they were the lesser gods supporting his royalty.
We reached out to some of the officers who investigated this case, but they declined to comment on the reports. Don Schaefer was a lieutenant in the Davenport Police Department at the time of the murder. He eventually became the Davenport Police Chief. He says the current prosecution team has asked him not to speak to the press about this case. But Bill Davis insists neither he nor the police department withheld any information from the defense, and he's proud of the work they did.
All of the people who participated in the investigation, I owe a debt of gratitude, and so does the community. From the guy who took the car apart and put it back together, to the chemist in the lab, to the policeman who knocked on the door tirelessly, I owe all of those people, as a citizen, a debt of gratitude.
As Gary McHenrick said, these reports have potentially exculpatory evidence that could point to another suspect in some aspects of the crime, possibly Jennifer's stepfather, Joseph Glenn. One of the reports cited by the Iowa Appellate Court was filed after a woman came to police shortly after Jennifer's murder. She allegedly shared a story about Joseph Glenn that happened about 1 week prior. The woman was a drug customer and didn't have enough money for a purchase. She offered to let Joseph Glenn keep her video camera as collateral. The woman told police Joseph Glenn said he could use the camera to record sexual acts with his stepdaughter, Jennifer. Jennifer's mother, Sherry, denies any sexual abuse.
You know, I know the way he talks shit and always thinks the shit don't stink or something like that, but Joe wouldn't hurt a fling.
But she and Joseph divorced in 2003. He left the Quad Cities, and nobody knows where to find him. So now, Stanley is facing his third trial, nearly 27 years after Jennifer was murdered. Questions still remain. Did Stanley actually do it? Did he have help? Is he innocent? He has the presumption of innocence going into the new trial. John Hanlon from the Innocence Project says this case follows the same pattern as many wrongful conviction cases.
You have a bad crime, a child victim. At trial, they show these pictures, which very often do away with the presumption of innocence. They're horrific. I've been in a courtroom when these kinds of pictures have been shown before, and the effect on all of us is overwhelming. But then there's no physical evidence, so what are we going to do? We're going to use informants, and then we're not going to tell the defense that this informant has been used 87 prior times. And then we're going to put a snitch into the cell with the guy who we just tunnel visioned into being our suspect within 72 hours, because that's the tunnel vision time period that they have traditionally followed. And then we're going to withhold evidence of 78 potentially exculpatory reports. This is a pattern. I would urge everybody just to kind of take a breath and stop for a second and just realize we just discussed the factual scenario of this case, and we ask a lot of questions about the crime and the parents and the timeline and all these things. And one of the facts that worked its way in is the various aspects of the police conduct. And we accept that as part of our discussion, as if it's the same as any other fact. What the police did in this case is outrageous.
Next time on Suspect Convictions, we'll look at the life of Stanley Liggins. From his childhood in Mississippi,
but my mom always said that he was the best child she had in the house,
to his run-ins with the law.
The fact that he was arrested for sexually molesting a 9-year-old girl and he was out on bond, and then 1 month later, Jennifer.
That's next time on Suspect Convictions. Production assistance comes from Alfredo Montega. Thanks to WVIK CEO Jay Pierce and WVIK staff Jared Johnson, Michelle O'Neill, Herb Trix, and Dave Garner. All archived audio was generously provided by WQAD-TV, Channel 8 in the Quad Cities.